This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When we talk about learning a second language in school, we're usually talking about Spanish or French or Mandarin. But one of the most important languages a student can learn today is computer code. And it seems not many girls are signing up.
So if we don't have women as part of these jobs from an economic perspective, we're losing out.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from the founder of the group, Girls Who Code. We'll also talk to Henry Winkler about his diagnosis of dyslexia and the books he writes for kids growing up with the same issues. And we'll spend an academic minute with political satire in a post-truth world. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Is embracing risk and failure something to which we should all aspire? Reshma Sujani, the founder of Girls Who Code, says, absolutely. During her race as the first Indian-American woman to run for U.S. Congress, a race she did not win, Sujani visited local schools and saw the gender gap in computing classes firsthand, which led her to start Girls Who Code, now on track to become the largest pipeline of future female engineers in the United States. Sujani has also served as deputy public advocate for New York City and promotes a new model of female leadership focused on mentorship and sponsorship and charting your own course. Lauren Schiller, the host of the show Inflection Point, visited Reshma Sujani to find out why it's so critical for our society that girls learn to code.
One of the TV shows I've been loving this year is Silicon Valley. It takes every stereotype of the tech culture and makes unrelenting, cringe-inducing fun of it. But if you watch the show, you'll notice that its bro culture of programming feels pretty accurate. Only about a quarter of computer professionals are women, and that's actually down from 1990, when it was at 36%. Girls Who Code is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to change all that by closing the gender gap in computer science. Founded in 2012 by Reshma Sujani, the program is on track to educate more than 40,000 girls in all 50 states this year. Her goal? 1 million women in computer science by 2020. And we'll need them. In less than 10 years, the United States will have 1.7 million jobs for engineers and computing professionals. Without girls, we will literally not have enough qualified people to fill these jobs. Welcome, Reshma.
Hi, how are you?
I want to start with a definition of what it means to code.
Sure. So I would say in its simplest definition, coding is telling a computer what to do or telling a machine what to do.
Now, why is it important to have more female coders for our society?
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe that coding in the 21st century is going to be a basic skill set, like reading and writing. And when you have women who are half of the student body in college, right, half of those in the labor force, 40% of all breadwinners, and most of these jobs, you know, like, for example, 71% of jobs in STEM are in computer science, and they pay a pretty good salary, right, a great salary. So if we don't have women as part of these jobs from an economic perspective, we're losing out. And I think a lot of these jobs are innovative, right? They're solving the problems of today and tomorrow, whether it's cancer or climate change, or they're building the next generation companies that that we use on social media, like Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. And if you don't have women as part of this growth, we're missing out.
Do you think that girls code different things or solve different problems than boys do?
I mean, I think that, like, for, you know, studies show that 74% of girls want to pick a profession that's about changing the world. So I do think that girls are thinking about their community and their world and how to make it better. So maybe their mom's obese or their brother's dyslexic, right? Or they were bullied in school or they walked past a homeless person and they want to figure out how to get them access to food. I do think that intuitively we are problem solvers and we're community oriented and we're change agents. And so I think that we'll see that as women get more access to technical skills, they're going to use those skills to solve problems.
What are some examples of what girls in your program have used technology to do?
Gosh, everything. So some of my favorite, one of our first girls, she was 16 and she built an algorithm to help detect whether a cancer is benign or malignant. We had a girl, Jasmine, I think in two programs ago, she built an app called Wacky Words to help people in her community who didn't have access to, you know, expensive SAT tutors to learn SAT words. We had two girls, Sophie and Andy, who built a game called Tampon Run to fight against the menstruation taboo, because every girl gets her period, right? And many girls across the world will drop out of school when they do get their period, but we don't talk about it. So they built a really fun game called Tampon Run to just bring attention, right, and awareness to this issue.
So it's actually available in the App Store?
It is. Download it now.
Forget Candy Crush. We're going on a tampon run.
It's totally addictive. I do play it, I will admit, all the time.
Are you tracking the girls who graduate from your programs to see if they're continuing with their project or going into an engineering or computing field?
Yeah. I think part of the problem from an education perspective is just 1 out of 10 American schools offers computer science, and only 25,000 kids took the APCS exam, and less than 4,000 of them were girls. In three states, Mississippi being one of them, no girls took the CS exam. And a Google study showed that if, you know, 39% of girls will, if they don't take CS when they're in high school, they're not going to take it in college. And so you got to start building that pipeline much earlier than in college if you want to change the number of women in technology. And so for us, it's really about how do we measure and evaluate the success of our programs and building that pipeline. And so we spend a lot of resources on really smart people who do that. And what we have found is in our summer programs, about 90% of our girls are going on to major or minor in computer science, and 77% were not going to before Girls Who Code. And the number for our clubs girls is about, you know, in the 70s. So our results are incredible, right? And show you that high school is not too late to change what girls think they want to do with their lives. And when you show them what computer science is and what they can do and create and build when they have coding skills, it really opens up their mind and their world to what they think they want to do with their life. So we're absolutely tracking them. And I think the other kind of opportunity that we see is that even once women get into college, when they're in computer science, about half of them will drop out. And so our question is like, if you build a community of girls and we introduce girls to one another, they have support, they can lean on each other, they can learn to be brave with one another, can you reduce that attrition rate? And as Girls Who Code grows, when we've only been around for, you know, 6 years, and so our numbers of girls in college are growing, because we're growing at about 300% every year. And so we're excited to see the effect that Girls Who Code is also going to have on not just building the pipeline, but the attrition rate once they're in.
Yeah, because I've read that the number of female engineers graduated from college in an engineering job is actually going down.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So do you have a kind of a ramp timeline that you figured out where you expect to see an impact from your programs? You've got very ambitious goals, right?
Yeah, 1 million girls by 2020. And that's where we came up with that number. We backed end into the jobs that are open and what it would take to get parity. And so, you know, assuming that not all of our girls are going to stick with it, we really came to a conclusion that if we taught 1 million girls by 2020, we could get to parity. You know, it's funny that you say that the number of women are going down. I think it's because the number of men who are opting to go into engineering and computer science is going up.
Right, because it's a percentage. You're right.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, we had McKinsey actually did a lot of this research for us. And what they found is that the number of men opting into computer science in 2011 grew dramatically, but the number of women stayed the same. And I always say that it's because of the social network. Right? The social network came out and you learned about Mark Zuckerberg and all guys said, wow, I want $100 billion exit. You know, how do I do that when I'm in college? And that same impact, that same motivation of trying to build a big company and make a lot of money didn't make a difference for women, right? It wasn't the thing that motivated them. And so that's really a lot of the work that we're doing is, you know, how do we get girls excited about coding and see it as something that they want to do with their lives?
You can do all the training you can, which will increase the number of girls that have the skill set that will increase the likelihood of them actually going into it for college and then for a career. But barriers like stereotypes of what a coder looks like or acts like, you know, like you mentioned the movie The Social Network, or just simply cultural fit at work. How will your programs potentially affect those challenges?
Well, we've really decided in 2016 to really attack culture. And so, you know, we've been doing a lot of work. You know, we did a collaboration with Nickelodeon on a show that they have called Game Shakers. And so that will be really interesting. We just released these videos almost like a spoof, right, on why girls can't code because they get their period, they have boobs, and they have long eyelashes. And in less than 48 hours, it got 1 million views. And one of the interesting things when you look at the comment section is that girls are saying, well, what's coding, right? And so we're really thinking about interesting, provocative ways to get girls interested in this and to really shape culture and to tell the media, like, we're watching you, right? And we're going to pay attention to what you put on your television shows and in your movies. And we're going to make sure that girls are represented because you can't be what you cannot see. And, you know, it's funny, in the 1970s, only 10% of doctors and lawyers were women. And now that number is over 50%. And when I think about why I was inspired to be an attorney, it was because I was, you know, 13 or 14 and I saw Kelly McGillis on The Accused, in this movie Accused, and I thought she was awesome. And the impact of LA Law and Grey's Anatomy and Kelly McGillis, right? You, in the 80s and 90s and in 2000, you were constantly inundated with these smart, you know, beautiful, interesting women who were doctors and lawyers, and little girls said, yeah, me too. And the opposite thing is happening in technology. You know, from the 80s, you have Weird Science and Revenge of the Nerds, right? And War Games to, you know, Silicon Valley or, you know, on HBO today. And you have this myth of a programmer wearing a hoodie, you know, sitting in a basement somewhere. He hasn't showered and he's drinking a Red Bull. And little girls look at him and be like, you know, not only do I not want to be him, I don't even want to be friends with him, right? And so they're opting out because they don't see themselves in the reflection of these, quote, you know, coders and entrepreneurs in media.
That's it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, that these women are beautiful and smart and, you know, doing these careers that girls could now consider because they're seeing them. This question isn't necessarily in, you know, the wheelhouse of girls who code, but what a programmer looks like, you know, does she have to be beautiful?
No, she can be whoever she wants. And I think that's the point. But we have definitely presented what a programmer looks like. And it's not a woman. And he's not social, right? And it's not seen as a collaborative job. And it's not seen as something cool. I mean, listen, you got to meet girls where they're at. And the reality is today in America, tween girls decide what's cool and what's not cool. And they've decided that coding is not cool or not something that they want to do. And so we do have to make it cool. We do have to make it interesting.
Do you think boys and men should feel threatened by this potential onslaught of coding women?
Funny. You know, no. I always think, because I speak to a lot of male audiences, and I'm like, you know, they're clapping, but are they really crying inside? You know, because if this works, like, it changes things for them, right? See, I think that there's this generation of men, like my husband. My husband majored in computer science. He's an entrepreneur. And, you know, they're not going to put up with it. You know, they're not going to put up with the fact that their daughter can't be whatever she wants to be. And I think that they want a more inclusive world for her, too.
How much have you engaged the tech companies in this mission? Are they on board?
Oh, full-fledged partners. You know, I always feel like, you know, Girls Who Code's not, we're a nonprofit, but it's not charity. You know, we're trying to solve a business problem for them. And we're building the pipeline for them. And that's why, you know, we have over 100 corporate partners. We're running 78 summer immersion programs, hundreds, and probably at this point, thousands of tech employees either volunteer in some way, shape, or form for Girls Who Code at clubs or in summer programs. And for them, it's like, you know, Microsoft, IBM, you know, AT&T, Twitter, you know, Facebook, they've been with us for several years. And they've doubled their, or tripled the programs that they're hosting at their office. Like, they've reaped massive benefits, not just, you know, in potentially building a pipeline of young women that they will go on to hire as interns and as full-time employees, but for their employees, right? Retention of women is a huge issue for many of these companies. And so what better way to show your commitment than to have a Girls Who Code program on site and having your employees participate in mentorship and sponsorship of them?
What do you think makes for a good coder? I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that you feel like it should be something that's taught, like reading and writing and reading, writing, arithmetic, right? So With coding, does it take a special skill? Do you have to have an affinity? Anyone can learn it?
I think anyone can learn it. Honestly, like a lot of coding is it's computational thinking. It's logical thinking. It's how to solve a problem. You don't have to be good at algebra or math to be good at coding. And, I was a lawyer. I think lawyers are probably going to be great coders, right? Because that's, you're thinking about logic games, you're thinking about process and, how do you solve something and how do you talk your way through a solution? And that's a lot of what coding is. I also just feel like it's about being comfortable, right? Because technology is going to be a part of everything we do. And again, because of that perfection thing, if we're not comfortable with a topic, we're going to stay away from it. So we might have a great business idea and every business idea is going to have a technical component, but we may be afraid to start our company because we're afraid to really converse with engineers because we think that they're going to have some knowledge we don't have. So even being able to know enough that you can talk with a technical person is really important.
What's the best advice that you've been given about initiating change?
Just to do it. I think sometimes we overthink things. And I think with Girls Who Code, if I had overthought it, if that idea didn't come to me at a certain moment in time where I was a little bit like, I've been through so much, I'm just going to build and create. And I had gone through the experience at age 33 of like building over $1 million campaign. I don't think I ever would have done it. And so people always say to me, I have this idea, that idea. I'm like, great, just try it. Just start it. Like build a pilot.
Reshma, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That was Reshma Sujani, founder of Girls Who Code, speaking with Lauren Schiller, the host of the show Inflection Point, produced for KALW. You can hear more of this interview at inflectionpointradio.org. Still to come, one of the biggest TV stars ever talks about living with dyslexia. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Beginning in 1974, Henry Winkler became a household name starring as Arthur Fonzarelli for 11 seasons on the TV show Happy Days. About midway through that run, at age 31, he finally found out why he always had such trouble reading and concentrating. He was diagnosed with dyslexia. Now, the 71-year-old actor, producer, and author writes books for children experiencing the same difficulties he did while in school. The Hank Zipser series is about a boy growing up in New York City with dyslexia. We spoke recently, and we talked about what it was like growing up with dyslexia.
Well, you know what happens, honestly, when a child has trouble in school, when a child has trouble, because their brain is wired differently, which is hereditary, but when a kid has a problem, they see that they're having a problem, and their self-esteem plummets. You know, a kid doesn't wake up in the morning and go, wow, I think I'm going to be an idiot today. I think I'm going to be disruptive today. They can't help themselves. And so what you do is you start thinking you're less than. And so, as a parent, I knew once I learned what I had, that I had dyslexia. As a parent, I looked at all my three kids and my grandchildren completely differently. And if you're quiet and you look at your child and you listen to your child, they will tell you what they need from us.
So you came up with Hank Zipser.
I did, with my partner Lynn Oliver. And we just turned in our 32nd novel. And the newest one, Always Watch Out for Flying Potato Salad, comes out on the 31st of January.
And you have an animated series with that too, right?
No, there is a wonderful series, a live-action series. I could not sell Hank Zipser to television in America. So we sold it to the BBC, and it is now a hit on the BBC, and we've completed 3 years.
I always try to look at someone's Wikipedia page and say, okay, I don't believe that, so I'm going to ask you right now. Do you have an Order of the British Empire?
I do. I used to do a play at Christmas time in England, and I traveled all over. And while I was there, I would travel all over England and visit schools and talk to the children about the concept that there's greatness inside every single person in this room that I'm talking to. And your job is to figure out what your greatness is. And I would ask the kids, anybody know what they're great at? And one was great at soccer, and one was great at math, and one was great at drawing, and one was great at science, and one was great at being a plasterer. He was an apprentice plasterer, because I talked to kids from kindergarten to 12th grade. That's what I did. And then the Queen said, I'm going to give you this award because of what you have done for the children here in England.
Well, if you keep it up, you might be Sir Hank one day.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Right now, I'm so happy. I'm blessed with the life that I lead.
Henry Winkler is... Oh, come on, he's Henry Winkler. His latest Hank Zipser book, co-written with Lynn Oliver, is called Always Watch Out for Flying Potato Salad. So how do you write political satire when the truth already looks like something someone made up? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Are we entering a golden age of political satire? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Matt Fotis, assistant professor and co-chair of the theater department at Albright College, discusses this art form in the age of post-truth.
Donald Trump's presidency is ushering in a new era in American politics, and with it, a new era in political satire, the age of post-truth. With Trump railing against the press on a seemingly daily basis, and tweeting his own facts, satire is poised to play an important role during his presidency. But what will post-truth satire look like in Trump's America? Though it is relatively young in its present form, satirizing presidential politics has undergone a radical shift in recent years. Many of the earliest presidential satirists sought to illuminate the absurd within the real. Through the latter half of the 20th century, presidential satirists mainly worked to amplify their targets, making them more extreme, more out of touch, more absurd. The truth these satirists sought was not found in the real, but in the absurd amplification of the real. After 9/11 and during George W. Bush's presidency, satire began to shift. The truth became harder to find, thanks in part to the secrecy of the Bush White House and the patriotically correct reporting of the media, who seemed tentative to question lest they be seen as unpatriotic. With the campaign of Donald J. Trump pushing all notions of normal to the wayside, satirists have attacked Trump in much the same way Tina Fey attacked Sarah Palin, by repeating Trump's own words. While SNL and others, most notably his Republican primary challengers and Hillary Clinton, have tried to use Trump's words against him to amplify the real behind the absurd, the strategy has proven largely ineffective, both politically and satirically. So how can satire succeed in the age of post-truth? By satirizing it. Satire has always sought to reveal truth, and in our current climate, that charge has never been more important or seemingly more difficult.
That was Matt Fotis of Albright College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.